Side 6. Domes of Fire. The Tomoli, Book 1. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 202.
You see, Sparhawk, Strachan said, that's exactly what I meant about this girl. She's the most dishonest person I've ever known.
My Lord Strachan, Melodir protested.
But you are, my dear Baroness.
Strachan grinned.
You don't lie with your mouth. You lie with your entire person. You pose as someone whose head is filled with air, and then you puncture a facade I've spent a lifetime building with one single observation. Unauthorized conception, indeed. You've managed to trivialize the central tragedy of my entire life.
Can you ever forgive me?
Her eyes were wide and dishonestly innocent.
I give up, he said,
throwing his hands in the air in mock surrender.
Where was I? Oh, yes, Mirtai's apparent change of personality. I think the rite of passage among the Aetons is very significant to them, and that's another reason our beloved little giantess is reverting to the social equivalent of baby talk. And Gessa's obviously going to put her through the rite when we reach her homeland, so she's enjoying the last few days of childhood to the hilt.
"Can I ride with you, Father?"
Danae asked.
"If you wish."
The little princess rose from her seat in the carriage, handed Rollo to Aileen, and Murr to Baroness Melodir, and held out her hands to Sparhawk. He lifted her to her usual seat in front of his saddle.
"Take me for a ride, Father,"
she coaxed, in her most little-girl tone.
"We'll be back in a bit,"
Sparhawk told his wife, and cantered away from the carriage.
Strachan can be so tedious at times,
Danae said tartly. I'm glad Melodir's the one who's going to have to modify him.
What?
Sparhawk was startled.
Where are your eyes, Father?
I wasn't actually looking. Do they really feel that way about each other?
She does. She'll let him know how he feels when she's ready. What happened in Darsus?
Sparhawk wrestled with his conscience a bit at that point.
Would you say that you're a religious personage? He asked carefully.
That's a novel way to put it.
Just answer the question, Danae. Are you or are you not affiliated with a religion?
Well, of course I am, Sparhawk. I'm the focus of a religion.
Then, in a general sort of way, you could be defined as a clergyman, person?
What are you getting at, Sparhawk?
Just say yes, Danae. I'm tiptoeing around the edges of violating an oath, and I need a technical excuse for it.
I give up. Yes, technically you could call me a church personage. It's a different church, of course, but the definition still fits.
Thank you. I swore not to reveal this except to another clergyman. Personage. You're a clergy person, so I can tell you.
That's sheer sophistry, Sparhawk.
I know, but it gets me off the hook. Baron Kotick's brother-in-law, Elrond, is Saber.
He gave her a suspicious look.
Have you been tampering again?
Me?
You're starting to stretch the potentials of coincidence a bit, Danae, he said. You knew what I just told you all along, didn't you?
Not the details, no. What you call omniscience is a human concept. It was dreamed up to make people think that they couldn't get away with anything. I get hints, little flashes of things, that's all. I knew there was something significant in Kotick's house, and I knew that if you and the others listened carefully, you'd hear about it.
It's like intuition, then?
That's a very good word for it, Sparhawk. Ours is a little more developed than yours, and we pay close attention to it. You humans tend to ignore it, particularly you men. But something else happened in Darsus, didn't it?
He nodded.
That shadow put in another appearance. Emban and I were talking with Archimandrite Monsel, and we were visited.
Whoever's behind this is very stupid, then.
The troll gods? Isn't that part of the definition of them?
We're not absolutely certain it's the troll god, Sparhawk.
Wouldn't you know? I mean, isn't there some way you can identify who's opposing you?
She shook her head.
I'm afraid not, Sparhawk. We can conceal ourselves from each other. The stupidity of that appearance in Darsus certainly suggests the troll gods, though. We haven't been able to make them understand why the sun comes up in the east as yet. They know it's going to come up every morning, but they're never sure just exactly where.
You're exaggerating.
Of course I am. She frowned. Let's not set our feet in stone on the idea that we're dealing with the troll gods just yet, though. There are some very subtle differences. Of course, that may be the result of their encounter with you in the Temple of Azash. You frightened them very much, you know. I'd be more inclined to suspect an alliance between them and somebody else. I think the troll gods would be more direct. If there is somebody else involved, he's just a bit childish. He hasn't been out in the world. He surrounded himself with people who aren't bright, and he's judging all humans by his worshippers. That appearance at Darsus was really a blunder, you know. He didn't have to do it, and all he really managed was to confirm what you'd already told that clergyman. You did tell him what's happening, didn't you?
Sparhawk nodded.
We really need to get to Sarsos and talk with Sephrenia.
You're going to speed up the journey again, then?
I think I'd better. I'm not entirely sure what the ones on the other side are doing yet, but they're starting to move faster for some reason, so we'd better see what we can do to keep up. Take me back to the carriage, Sparhawk. Stragan's probably finished showing off his education by now, and the smell of your armor is beginning to make me nauseous.
Although there was a community of interests among the three disparate segments of the force escorting the Queen of Alenia, Sparhawk, Engessa, and Kring decided to make some effort to keep the Paloi, the Church Knights, and the Aetons more or less separate from each other. Cultural differences obviously made a general mingling unwise. The possibilities for misunderstandings were simply too numerous to be ignored. Each leader stressed the need for the strictest of courtesy and formality to his forces, and the end result was a tense and exaggerated stiffness. In a very real sense, the Aetons, the Paloi, and the Knights were allies rather than comrades. The fact that very few of the Aetons spoke Alenic added to the distance between the component parts of the small army moving out under the treeless expanse of the steppes. They encountered the eastern Paloi some distance from the town of Pella in central Astel. Kring's ancestors had migrated from this vast grassland some 3,000 years earlier, but despite the separation of time and distance, the two branches of the Paloi family were remarkably similar in matters of dress and custom. The only really significant differences seemed to be the marked preference of the eastern Paloi for the javelin, as opposed to the saber favored by Kring's people. After a ritual exchange of greetings, Kring and his eastern cousin sat cross-legged on the turf, taking salt together and talking of affairs, while two armies warily faced each other across 300 yards of open grass. The decision not to go to war with each other today was apparently reached, and Kring led his host and kinsman to the carriage to introduce him all around. The domi of the eastern Paloi was named Takumi. He was somewhat taller than Kring, but his head was also shaved, a custom among those horsemen dating back to antiquity. Takumi greeted them all politely.
It is passing strange to see Paloi allied with foreigners, he noted. Domi Kring has told me of the conditions which prevail in Eosia, but I had not fully realized that they had led to such peculiar arrangements. Of course, he and I have not spoken together for more than 10 years.
You've met before, Domi Takumi? Patriarch Emban asked, with a certain surprise.
Yes, Your Grace, Kring replied. Domi Takumi journeyed to Pelosia with the King of Astel some years back. He made a point of looking me up.
King Alberon's father was much wiser than his son, Takumi explained, and he read a great deal. He saw many similarities between Pelosia and Astel, so he paid a state visit to King Soros. He invited me to go along. His expression became one of distaste. I might have declined if I'd known he was going to travel by boat. I was sick every day for 2 months. Domi Kring and I got on well together, though. He was kind enough to take me with him to the marches to hunt ears.
Did he share the profits with you, Domi Takumi? Elana asked him.
What was that, Queen Elana?
Takumi looked baffled. Kring, however, laughed nervously and flushed just a bit. Then Mirtai strode up to the carriage.
Is this the one?
Takumi asked Kring.
Kring nodded happily.
Isn't she stupendous?
Magnificent,
Takumi agreed fervently, his tone almost reverential. Then he dropped to one knee.
Doma,
he greeted her, clasping both hands in front of his face. Mirtai looked inquiringly at Kring.
It's a Paloi word, beloved, he explained. It means Domi's mate.
That hasn't been decided yet, Kring, she pointed out.
Can there be any doubt, beloved? He replied.
Takumi was still down on one knee.
You shall enter our camp with all honors, Doma Mirtai, he declared. For among our people you are a queen. All shall kneel to you, and all shall give way to you. Poems and songs shall be composed in your honor, and rich gifts shall be bestowed upon you.
Well now, Mirtai said.
Your beauty is clearly divine, Doma Mirtai,
Takumi continued, warming to his subject.
Your very presence brightens a drab world and puts the sun to shame. I am awed at the wisdom of my brother Kring in having selected you as his mate. Come straightway to our camp, Divine One, so that my people may adore you.
My goodness, Elana breathed. Nobody's ever said anything like that to me.
We just didn't want to embarrass you, my queen, Stragan told her blandly. We feel that way about you, of course, but we didn't want to be too obvious about it.
Well said, Uloth approved.
Mirtai looked at Kring with a new interest.
Why didn't you tell me about this, Kring?
She asked him.
I thought you knew, beloved.
I didn't,
she replied. Her lower lip pushed forward slightly in a thoughtful kind of pout.
But I do now, she added. Have you chosen an Oma as yet?
Sparhawk serves me in that capacity, beloved.
Why don't you go have a talk with Eitan and Gessa, Sparhawk?
She suggested.
Tell him for me that I do not look upon Domi Kring's suit with disfavor.
That's a very good idea, Mirtai, Sparhawk replied. I'm surprised I didn't think of it myself.
Chapter 14. The town of Pella, in central Astel, was a major trading center where merchants and cattle buyers came from all parts of the empire to do business with the Paloi herders. It was a shabby-looking, unfinished sort of place. Many of its buildings were no more than ornate fronts with large tents erected behind them. No attempt had ever been made to pave its rutted streets, and the passage of strings of wagons and herds of cattle raised a cloud of dust that entirely obscured the town most of the time. Beyond the poorly defined outskirts lay an ocean of tents, the portable homes of the nomadic Paloi. Takumi led them through the town, and beyond, to a hilltop where a number of brightly striped pavilions encircled a large open area. A canopy held aloft by poles shaded a place of honor at the very top of the hill, and the ground beneath that canopy was carpeted and strewn with cushions and furs. Mirtai was the absolute center of attention. Her rather scanty marching clothes had been covered with a purple robe that reached to the ground, an indication of her near-royal status. Kring and Takumi formally escorted her to the ceremonial center of the camp and introduced her to Takumi's wife, Vida, a sharp-faced woman who also wore a purple robe, and looked at Mirtai with undisguised hostility. Sparhawk and the rest joined the Paloi leaders in the shade as honored guests. The face of Takumi's wife grew darker and darker as Paloi warriors vied with each other to heap extravagant compliments upon Mirtai as they were presented to Kring and his purported bride-to-be. There were gifts and a number of songs praising the beauty of the golden giantess.
How did they find time to make up songs about her?
Talon quietly asked Stragan.
I'd imagine that the songs have been around for a long time, Stragan replied. They've substituted Mirtai's name, that's all. I expect there'll be poems as well. I know a third-rate poet in Imsat who makes a fairly good living writing poems and love letters for young nobles too lazy or uninspired to compose their own. There's a whole body of literature with blank spaces in it that serves in such situations.
They just fill in the blanks with the girl's name?
Talon demanded incredulously.
It wouldn't really make much sense to fill them in with some other girl's name, would it?
That's dishonest, Talon exclaimed. What a novel attitude, Talon, Patriarch Emban laughed, particularly coming from you. You aren't supposed to cheat when you're telling a girl how you feel about her, Talon insisted. Talon had begun to notice girls. They had been there all along, of course, but he had not noticed them before. Now he had some rather surprisingly strong convictions. It was to the credit of his friends that not one of them laughed at his peculiar expression of integrity. Baroness Melodyr, however, impulsively embraced him. "What was that all about?" he asked her, a little suspiciously. "Oh, nothing," she replied, touching a gentle hand to his cheek. "When was the last time you shaved?" she asked him. "Last week sometime, I think, or maybe the week before." "You're due again, I'd say. You're definitely growing up, Talon." The boy flushed slightly. Princess Danae gave Sparhawk a sly little smirk. After the gifts and the poems and songs came the demonstrations of prowess. Kring's tribesmen demonstrated their proficiency with their sabers. Takumi's men did much the same with their javelins, which they either cast or used as short lances. Sir Barrett unhorsed an equally youthful Cyrenic knight, and two blonde-braided Genidians engaged in a fearsomely realistic mock axe fight. "It's all relatively standard, of course, Emban," Ambassador Oscania said to the Patriarch of Busera. The friendship of the two men had progressed to the point where they had begun to discard titles. Warrior cultures almost totally circumscribed their lives with ceremonies. Emban smiled. "I've noticed that, Oscania. Our church knights are the most courteous and ceremonial men I know."
"Prudence, Your Grace," Uloth explained cryptically.
"You'll get used to that in time, Your Excellency," Tinian assured the ambassador. "Sir Uloth hates to waste words."
"I wasn't being mysterious, Tinian," Uloth told him. "I was only pointing out that you almost have to be polite to a man who's holding an axe."
Eitan Engesa rose and bowed a bit stiffly to Aelana.
"May I test your slave, Aelana Queen?" he asked.
"How exactly do you mean, Eitan Engesa?" she asked warily.
"She approaches the time of the rite of passage. We must decide if she is ready. I will not harm her. These others are demonstrating their skill. Eitana Mirtai and I will participate. It will be a good time for the test."
"As you think best, Eitan," Aelana consented, "as long as the Eitana does not object."
"If she is truly Eitan, she will not object, Aelana Queen."
He turned abruptly and crossed to where Mirtai sat with the Paloi.
"Mirtai is certainly the center of things today," Melodyr observed.
"I think it's very nice," Aelana said. "She keeps herself in the background most of the time. She's entitled to a bit of attention."
"It's political, you realize," Stragan told her. "Takumi's people are showering Mirtai with attention for Kring's benefit."
"I know, Stragan, but it's nice all the same."
She looked speculatively at her golden slave.
"Sparhawk, I'd take it as a personal favor if you'd actively pursue the marriage negotiations with Eitan Engesa. Mirtai deserves some happiness."
"I'll see what I can arrange for her, my queen."
Mirtai readily agreed to Engesa's proposed test. She rose gracefully to her feet, unfastened the neck of her purple robe, and let it fall. The Paloi gasped. Their womenfolk were customarily dressed in far more concealing garments. The sneer on the face of Takumi's wife, Vida, however, was a bit wan. Mirtai was significantly female. She was also fully armed, and that also shocked the Paloi. She and Engesa moved to the area in front of the canopy, curtly inclined their heads to each other, and drew their swords. Sparhawk thought he knew the differences between contest and combat, but what followed blurred that boundary for him. Mirtai and Engesa seemed to be fully intent on killing each other. Their swordsmanship was superb, but their manner of fencing involved a great deal more physical contact than did Western-style fighting.
"It looks like a wrestling match with swords," Kalton observed to Uloth.
"Yes," Uloth agreed. "I wonder if a man could do that in an axe fight."
If you could kick somebody in the face, the way she just did, and then follow up with an axe stroke, you could win a lot of fights in a hurry.
I knew she was going to do that to him.
Colton chuckled as Engesa landed flat on his back in the dust. She did it to me once. Engesa, however, did not lie gasping on the ground as Colton had. He rolled away from Mirtai instead, and came to his feet with his sword still in his hand. He raised his blade in a kind of salute, and then immediately attacked again. The test continued for several more minutes, until a watching Eitan sharply banged his fist on his breastplate to signal the end of the match. The man who had signaled was much older than his compatriots, or so it seemed. His hair was white. Nothing else about him seemed any different, however. Mirtai and Engesa bowed formally to each other, and he returned her to her place where she once again drew on her robe and sank down onto a cushion. Vida no longer sneered.
"She is fit," Engesa reported to Eilana. He reached up under his breastplate and tenderly touched a sore spot. "More than fit," he added. "She is a skilled and dangerous opponent. I am proud to be the one she will call father. She will add luster to my name."
"We rather like her, Eitan Engesa," Eilana smiled. "I'm so glad you agree with us."
She let the full impact of that devastating smile wash over the stern-faced Eitan, and hesitantly, almost as if in spite of himself, he smiled back. "I think he lost 2 fights today," Talon whispered to Sparhawk.
"So it would seem," Sparhawk replied. "We can never catch up with him, friend Sparhawk," Takumi said that evening as they all relaxed on carpets near a flaring campfire. "These steppes are open grasslands, with only a few groves of trees. There isn't really any place to hide, and you can't ride a horse through tall grass without leaving a trail a blind man could follow. They come out of nowhere, kill the herders, and run off the cattle. I followed one of those groups of raiders myself. They'd stolen 100 cattle, and they left a broad trail through the grass. After a few miles, the trail just ended. There was no sign that they'd dispersed. They just vanished. It was as if something had reached down and carried them off into the sky."
"Have there been any other disturbances, Domi?" Tinian asked carefully. "What I'm trying to say is, has there been unrest of any kind among your people? Wild stories, rumors, that sort of thing?"
"No, friend Tinian," Takumi smiled. "We are an open-faced people. We do not conceal our emotions from each other. I'd know if there were something afoot. I've heard about what's been happening over around Darsus, so I know why you ask. Nothing like that is happening here. We don't worship our heroes the way they do. We just try to be like them. Someone's stealing our cattle and killing our herdsmen." He looked a bit accusingly at Oscania. "I would not insult you for all the world, Your Honor," he said, "but you might suggest to the Emperor that he would be wise to have some of his Eitans look into it. If we have to deal with it ourselves, our neighbors won't like it very much. We of the Paloi tend to be a bit indiscriminate when someone steals our cattle."
"I'll bring the matter to His Imperial Majesty's attention," Oscania promised.
"Soon, friend Oscania," Takumi recommended. "Very soon."
"She's a highly skilled warrior, Sparhawk Knight," Engesa was saying the following morning as the two sat by a small fire.
"Granted," Sparhawk replied, "but by your own traditions, she's still a child."
"That's why it's my place to negotiate for her," Engesa pointed out. "If she were adult, she would do it herself. Children sometimes do not know their own worth."
"But a child cannot be as valuable as an adult."
"That's not always entirely true, Sparhawk Knight. The younger a woman, the greater her price."
"Oh, this is absurd," Eilana broke in.
The negotiations were of a delicate nature, and would normally have taken place in private. Normally, however, did not always apply to Sparhawk's wife.
"Your offer's completely unacceptable, Sparhawk."
"Whose side are you on, dear?" he asked her mildly.
"Mirtai's my friend. I won't permit you to insult her. 10 horses, indeed. I could get that much for Talon."
Were you planning to sell him, too?
I was just illustrating a point. Sir Tinian had also stopped by. Of all of their group, he was closest to Kring, and he keenly felt the responsibilities of friendship.
"What sort of offer would Your Majesty consider properly respectful?" he asked Aelana.
"Not a horse less than 60," she declared adamantly.
60? Tinian exclaimed. "You'll impoverish him. What kind of a life will Myrtai have if you marry her off to a pauper?"
"Kling's hardly a pauper, Sir Knight," she retorted. "He still has all that gold King Soros paid him for those Zemmok ears."
"But that's not his gold, Your Majesty," Tinian pointed out. "It belongs to his people."
Sparhawk smiled and motioned with his head to Engessa. Unobtrusively, the two stepped away from the fire.
"I'd guess that they'll settle on 30, Eitan Engessa," he tentatively suggested.
"Most probably,"
Engessa agreed.
"It seems like a fair number to me, doesn't it to you?"
It hovered on the verge of being an offer.
"It's more or less what I had in mind, Sparhawk Knight."
"Me too. Done then?"
"Done."
The two of them clasped hands.
"Should we tell them?"
the Eitan asked, the faintest hint of a smile touching his face.
"They're having a lot of fun," Sparhawk grinned. "Why don't we let them play it out? We can find out how close our guess was. Besides, these negotiations are very important to Kring and Myrtai. If we were to agree in just a few minutes, it might make them feel cheapened."
"You have been much in the world, Sparhawk Knight," Engessa observed. "You know well the hearts of men, and of women."
"No man ever truly knows the heart of a woman, Engessa Eitan," Sparhawk replied ruefully.
The negotiations between Tinian and Aelana had reached the tragic stage, each of them accusing the other of ripping out hearts and similar extravagances. Aelana's performance was masterful. The Queen of Alenia had a strong flair for histrionics, and she was a highly skilled orator. She extemporized at length upon Sir Tinian's disgraceful niggardliness, her voice rising and falling in majestic cadences. Tinian, on the other hand, was coolly rational, although he, too, became emotional at times. Kring and Myrtai sat holding hands not far away, their eyes filled with concern as they hung breathlessly on every word. Takumi's Poloi encircled the haggling pair, straining to hear. It went on for hours, and it was nearly sunset when Aelana and Tinian finally reached a grudging agreement, 30 horses, and concluded the bargain by spitting in their hands and smacking their palms together. Sparhawk and Engessa formalized the agreement in the same fashion, and a tumultuous cheer went up from the rapt Poloi. It had been a highly entertaining day all round, and that evening's celebration was loud and long.
"I'm exhausted," Aelana confessed to her husband after they had retired to their tent for the night.
"Poor dear," Sparhawk commiserated.
"I had to step in, though. You were just being too meek, Sparhawk. You'd have given her away. It's a good thing I was there. You'd have never managed to reach that kind of agreement."
"I was on the other side, Aelana, remember?"
"That's what I don't understand, Sparhawk. How could you treat poor Myrtai so disgracefully?"
"Rules of the game, love. I was representing Kring."
"I'm still very disappointed in you, Sparhawk."
"Well, fortunately, you and Tinian were there to get it all done properly. And Gessa and I couldn't have done half so well."
"It did turn out rather well, didn't it? Even though it took us all day."
"You were brilliant, my love. Absolutely brilliant." "I've been in some very shabby places in my life, Sparhawk," Stragan said the next morning. "But Pella's the absolute worst. It's been abandoned several times. Did you know that?" "Maybe abandoned isn't the right word. Moved is probably closer to the truth. Pella exists wherever the Poloi established their summer encampment." "I'd imagine that sends the mapmakers into hysterics." "More than likely. It's a temporary town, but it absolutely reeks of money. It takes a great deal of ready cash to buy a cattle herd."
"Were you able to make contact with the local thieves?"
"They contacted us, actually," Talon grinned.
A boy no more than 8 lifted Stragan's purse. He's very good, except that he doesn't run very well. I caught him within 50 yards. After we'd explained who we were, he was very happy to take us to see the man in charge.
Has the Thieves' Council made any decision as yet? Sparhawk asked Stragan.
They're still mulling it over, Stragan replied. They're a bit conservative here in Deresia. The notion of cooperating with the authorities strikes them as immoral for some reason. I sort of expect an answer when we get to Sarsos. The thieves of Sarsos carry a great deal of weight in the Empire. Did anything meaningful happen while we were gone?
Kring and Mirtai got betrothed.
That was quick. I'll have to congratulate them.
Why don't you two get some sleep? Sparhawk suggested. We'll be leaving for Sarsos tomorrow. Takumi's going to ride along with us to the edge of the steps. I think he'd like to go a bit farther, but the Styrix at Sarsos make him nervous.
He rose to his feet.
Get some sleep, he told them. I want to go have a talk with Oscania.
The Paloi encampment was quiet. It was early summer now, and the midday heat kept the nomads inside their tents. Sparhawk walked across the hard-packed earth toward the tent shared by Ambassador Oscania and Patriarch Emban. His chain mail jingled as he walked. Since they were in the secure encampment, the knights had decided to forego the discomfort of their formal armor. He found the two he sought sitting beneath a canopy at the side of their tent, eating a melon.
"Well met, Sir Knight," Oscania said as the Pandion approached.
"That's an archaic form of greeting, Oscania," Emban told him.
"I'm an archaic sort of fellow, Emban." "I was curious about something," Sparhawk said, joining them on the shaded carpet.
"It's a characteristic of the young, I suppose," Oscania smiled.
Sparhawk let that pass.
"This part of Astel seems quite different from what we ran into farther west," he observed.
"Yes," Oscania agreed. "Astel's the melting pot that gave rise to all Aline cultures, both here in Deresia and in Eosia as well."
"We might want to argue about that some day," Impan murmured.
"Deresia's older, that's all," Oscania shrugged. "That doesn't necessarily mean that it's better. Anyway, what you've seen of Astel so far is very much like what you'd encounter in the Aline kingdom of Pelosia, wouldn't you say?"
"There are similarities, yes," Sparhawk replied.
"The similarities will stop when we reach the edge of the steps. The western two-thirds of Astel are Aline. From the edge of the steps to the Aton border, Astel's Styrix."
"How did that happen?" Emban asked. "The Styrix in Eosia are widely dispersed. They live in their own villages and follow their own laws and customs."
"How cosmopolitan are you feeling today, Emban?"
"You're planning to insult my provincialism, I take it?"
"Not too much, I hope. Your prototypical Aline is a bigot."
Oscania held up one hand. "Let me finish before you explode. Bigotry is a form of egotism, and I think you have to concede that Alines have a very high opinion of themselves. They seem to feel that God smiles particularly for them."
"Doesn't he?"
Emban feigned surprise.
"Stop that. For reasons only God can understand, the Styrix particularly irritate the Alines."
"I have no trouble understanding it," Emban shrugged. "It's their superior attitude. They treat us as if we were children."
"From their perspective, we are, Your Grace," Sparhawk told him. "Styrix have been civilized for 40,000 years. We got started somewhat later."
"For whatever the reason," Oscania continued, "the initial impulse of the Alines has been to drive the Styrix out, or to kill them. That's why the Styrix migrated to Eosia much earlier than you Alines did. They were driven into the wilderness by Aline prejudice. Eosia was not the only wilderness, however. There's another that exists along the Aton border, and many Styrix fled there in antiquity. After the Empire was formed, we Tamils asked the Alines to stop molesting the Styrix living around Sarsos."
"Asked?"
"We were quite firm, and we did have all those Aetons with nothing else to do. We've agreed to let the Aline clergy deliver thunderous denunciations from the pulpit,
but we garrison enough Aetons around Sarsos to keep the two people separate. It's quieter that way, and we Tamils are extraordinarily fond of quiet. I think you gentlemen are in for a surprise when we reach Sarsos. It's the only true Styric city in the entire world. It's an astonishing place. God seems to smile in a very special way there.
You keep talking about God, Oscania, Amban noted. I thought a preoccupation with God was an Aline conceit.
You're more cosmopolitan than I thought, Your Grace.
Just exactly what do you mean when you use the word God, Your Excellency?
We use the term generically. Our Tamil religion isn't very profound. We tend to think that a man's relationship with his God, or gods, is his own affair.
That's heresy, you know. It would put the church out of business.
That's all right, Amban, Oscania smiled. Heresy's encouraged in the Tamil Empire. It gives us something to talk about on long, rainy afternoons.
They rode out with a huge Paloi escort the following morning. The party moving northeasterly looked not so much like an army on the march as it did a migration. Kring and Takumi rode more or less by themselves for the next several days, renewing their blood ties and discussing an exchange of breeding stock. Sparhawk attempted an experiment during the ride from Pella to the edge of the steppes, but try though he might, he could not detect any traces of Afriel's tampering with time and distance. The child goddess was simply too skilled, and her manipulations too seamless for him to detect them. Once, when she had joined him on Farron's back, he raised an issue that had been troubling him. I'm not trying to pry, but it seems that it's been about 50 days since we landed at Celestia. How long has it really been?
Quite a bit less than that, Sparhawk, she replied. Half that long at most.
I was sort of looking for an exact answer, Danae.
I'm not very good with numbers, Father. I know the difference between a few and a lot, and that's all that's really important, isn't it?
It's a bit imprecise, wouldn't you say?
Is precision all that important to you, Sparhawk?
You can't begin to think logically without precision, Danae.
Don't think logically, then. Try being intuitive for a change. You might even find that you like it.
How long, Danae? He insisted.
3 weeks.
She shrugged. That's a little better.
Well, more or less.
The edge of the steppes was marked by a dense forest of pale-trunked birches, and Takumi and his tribesmen turned back there. Since it was late in the day, the royal escort made camp on the edge of the forest so that they might follow the shaded road leading off through the trees in the full light of day. After they had settled down and the cooking fires were going, Sparhawk took Kring, and they went looking for Angessa.
"We have a peculiar situation here, gentlemen," he told them as they walked together near the edge of the forest.
"How so, Sparhawk Knight?" Angessa asked.
"We've got 3 different kinds of warriors in this group, and I'd imagine there are 3 different approaches to engagement. We should probably discuss the differences, so that we won't be working at cross purposes if trouble arises. The standard approach of the Church Knights is based on our equipment. We wear armor, and we ride large horses. Whenever there's trouble, we usually just smash the center of an opposing army.
We prefer to peel an enemy like an apple, Kring said. We ride around his force very fast and slice off bits and pieces as we go.
We fight on foot, Angessa supplied. We are trained to be self-sufficient, so we just rush the enemy and engage him hand to hand.
Does that work very well? Kring asked him.
It always has, Angessa shrugged.
If we happen to run into any kind of trouble, it probably wouldn't be a good idea for us all to dash right in, Sparhawk mused. We'd be stumbling all over each other. See what you think of this. If a force of any significant size tries to attack us, Kring and his men circle around behind them. I form up the knights and charge the center, and Aetan Angessa spreads his force out along a broad front. The enemy will sort of fold in behind the knights after we bash a hole in their center. They always do for some reason. Kring's attacks along the rear and the flanks will add to their confusion. They'll be disorganized,
and most of them will be cut off from their leaders in one way or another. That would be a good time for Engesa to attack. The best soldiers in the world don't function too well when nobody's close enough to give orders.
It's a workable tactic, Engesa conceded. It's a bit surprising to find that other people in the world know how to plan battles, too.
The story of man has pretty much been the story of one long battle, Eitan Engesa, Sparhawk told him. We are all experienced at it, so we devise tactics that take advantage of our strengths. Do we want to do it the way I suggested?
Kring and Engesa looked at each other.
Almost any plan will work, Kring shrugged, as long as we all know what we're doing.
How will we know when you're ready for us to attack? Engesa asked Sparhawk.
My friend Ulath has a horn, Sparhawk replied. When he blows it once, my knights will charge. When he blows it twice, Kring's men will start peeling off the rear elements. When we've got the enemy's full attention, I'll have Ulath blow three times. That's when you'll want to charge.
Engesa's eyes were alight. It's the sort of strategy that doesn't leave very many survivors among the enemy, Sparhawk Knight, he said.
That was sort of the idea, Engesa Eitan.
The birch forest lay on a long, gradual slope rising from the steps of Central Astel to the rugged foothills on the Eitan border. The road was broad and well-maintained, though it tended to wander a great deal. Engesa's unmounted Eitans ranged out about a mile on each side of the road, and for the first 3 days they reported no sightings of men, although they did encounter large herds of deer. Summer had not yet dried the lingering dampness from the forest floor, and the air in the sun-dappled shade was cool and moist, still smelling of new growth and renewal. Since the trees obstructed their vision, they rode cautiously. They set up their nighttime encampments while the sun was still above the horizon and erected certain rudimentary fortifications to prevent surprises after dark. On the morning of their fourth day in the forest, Sparhawk rose early and walked through the first steel-gray light of dawn to the line where the horses were picketed. He found Khalad there. Kirik's eldest son had snubbed Farron's head up close to a birch tree and was carefully inspecting the big roan's hooves.
I was just going to do that, Sparhawk said quietly. He seemed to be favoring his left forehoof yesterday.
Stone bruise, Khalad said shortly. You know, Sparhawk, you might want to give some thought to putting him out to pasture when we get back home. He's not a colt anymore, you know.
Neither am I, when you get right down to it. Sleeping on the ground's not nearly as much fun as it used to be.
You're just getting soft.
Thanks. Is this weather going to hold?
As nearly as I can tell, yes.
Khalad lowered Farron's hoof to the ground and took hold of the snubbing rope.
No biting, he cautioned the horse. If you bite me, I'll kick you in the ribs.
Farron's long face took on an injured expression.
He's an evil-tempered brute, Khalad noted. But he's far and away the smartest horse I've ever come across. You should put him to stud. It might be interesting to train intelligent colts for a change. Most horses aren't really very bright.
I thought horses were among the cleverest of animals.
That's a myth, Sparhawk. If you want a smart animal, get yourself a pig. I've never yet been able to build a pen that a pig couldn't think his way out of.
They're built a little close to the ground for riding. Let's go see how breakfast's coming.
Who's cooking this morning?
Carlton, I think. Ulath would know.
Carlton? Maybe I'll stay here and eat with the horses.
I'm not sure that a bucketful of raw oats would taste all that good.
I'd put it up against Carlton's cooking any day, my lord.
They rode out shortly after the sun rose and proceeded through the cool, sun-speckled forest. The birds seemed to be everywhere, and they sang enthusiastically. Sparhawk smiled as he remembered how Sephrenia had once punctured his illusion that birdsong was an expression of a love for music.
Actually, they're warning other birds to stay away, dear one, she had said. They're claiming possession of nesting sites. It sounds very pretty, but all they're really saying is, my tree, my tree, my tree.
Mirtai came back along the road late that morning, running with an effortless stride.
"Sparhawk," she said quietly when she reached the carriage, "Etan and Gess's scouts report that there are people up ahead."
"How many?" he asked, his tone suddenly all business.
"We can't be certain. The scouts didn't want to be seen. There are soldiers of some kind out there, and they seem to be waiting for us."
"Barret," Sparhawk said to the young knight, "why don't you ride on ahead and ask Calton and the others to join us? Don't run. Try to make it look casual."
"Right."
Barret rode forward at a trot. "Mirtai," the big knight said, trying to keep his voice calm, "is there any kind of defensible position nearby?"
"I was just coming to that," she replied. "There's a kind of hill about a quarter of a mile ahead. It sort of juts up from the floor of the forest. Boulders, mostly. They're covered over with moss."
"Could we get the carriage up there?" She shook her head. "You get to walk, then, my queen," he said to his wife.
"We don't know that they're hostile, Sparhawk," Ilana objected.
"That's true," he conceded. "But we don't know that they aren't, either. And that's far more important." Calton and the others came back along the column with Kring and Engessa. "Are they doing anything at all, Etan Engessa?" Sparhawk asked.
"Just watching, Sparhawk Knight. There are more of them than we thought at first. 1,000 at least. Probably a lot more."
"It's going to be tricky with all these trees," Calton pointed out. "I know," Sparhawk grunted. "Khalad, how close is it to noon?"
"About another hour, my lord,"
Khalad replied from the carriage driver's seat. "Close enough, then. There's a hill just up ahead. We'll ride onto it and make some show of stopping for our midday meal. Our friends here in the carriage will sort of stroll up to the top. The rest of us will spread out around the base of the hill. We'll build fires and rattle pots and pans together. Elana, be silly. I want you and the Baroness to do a lot of laughing up there on that hilltop. Stragan, take some men and erect a pavilion of some kind up there. Try to make it look festive. Move some rocks out of your way and sort of pile them up around the hilltop."
"A siege again, Sparhawk?" Ulof said disapprovingly. "Have you got a better idea?"
"Not really. But you know how I feel about sieges."
"Nobody said you had to like it, Ulof," Tinian told him.
"Spread the word," Sparhawk told them, "and let's try to make it all look very casual." They were tense as they proceeded along the road at a leisurely appearing pace. When they rounded a bend and Sparhawk saw the hill, he immediately approved of its strategic potentials. It was one of those rock piles that inexplicably rear up out of forests the world over. It was a conical heap of rounded boulders, perhaps 40 feet high, green with moss, and totally devoid of trees or brush. It stood about 200 yards to the left of the road. Talon rode to its base, dismounted, scampered up to the top, and looked around.
"It's perfect, my queen," he shouted back down. "You can see for miles up here. It's just what you were looking for."
"That's a nice touch," Bevier noted, "assuming that our friends out there speak Alenic, of course."
Stragan came forward from the line of pack horses, carrying a lute.
"A little finishing touch, my queen," he smiled to Elana.
"Do you play, my lord?" she asked him.
"Any gentleman plays, your majesty."
"Sparhawk doesn't."
"We're still working on a definition of Sparhawk, Queen Elana," Stragan replied lightly. "We're not altogether certain that gentleman really fits him. No offense intended, of course, old boy,"
he hastily assured the black-armored Pandion.
"A suggestion, Sparhawk," Tinian said.
"Go ahead."
"We don't know anything about those people out there, but they don't know anything about us, either. Or, at the most, very, very little."
"That's probably true."
"Just because they're watching doesn't mean they're planning an immediate attack, if they're even planning to attack at all. If they are, they could just sit and wait until we're back on the road again."
"All right.
But we're traveling with some giddy noblewomen, begging your majesty's pardon, and noblewomen don't really need reasons for the things they do."
"Your popularity isn't growing in certain quarters, Sir Tinian," Elana said ominously.
"I'm crushed. But couldn't your majesty decide, on a whim, that you absolutely adore this place,
and that you're bored with riding in a carriage? Under those circumstances, wouldn't it be natural for you to order a halt for the day?
It's not bad, Sparhawk, Carlton said. While we're all lunching, we can sort of unobtrusively fortify that hill a little better. Then, after a few hours, when it's obvious that we aren't going any further today, we can set up the usual evening camp, field fortifications and the like. We're not on any specific timetable, so half a day lost isn't going to put us behind any sort of schedule. The Queen's safety's a lot more important than speed right now, wouldn't you say?
You know how I'm going to answer that, Carlton.
I was sure I could count on you.
It's good, Sparhawk Knight, Engessa approved. Give my scouts one whole night to work with, and we'll not only know how many are out there, but their names as well.
Break a wheel, Ulaf added.
What was that, Sir Knight? Ambassador Oscania asked, looking perplexed.
That would give us another excuse for stopping, the Thalesian replied. If the carriage broke down, we'd have to stop.
Can you fix a wheel, Sir Ulaf?
No, but we can rig some kind of a skid to get us by until we can find a blacksmith.
Wouldn't a skid make the carriage jolt and bump around a great deal? Patriarch Emban asked with a pained look.
Probably. Ulaf shrugged.
I'm almost certain we can find some other reason to stop, Sir Knight. Have you any idea of how uncomfortable that would be?
I didn't really give it much thought, Your Grace, Ulaf replied blandly. But then I won't be riding in the carriage, so it wouldn't bother me in the slightest.
Chapter 15. The addition of a dozen female Etons added to the subterfuge of a courtly gathering on the hilltop, although it was difficult to persuade the Eton girls that their faces would not break if they smiled, or that the gods had issued no commandment against laughing. Barrett and a number of other youthful knights entertained the ladies while casually clearing inconvenient, and not a few convenient, bushel-basket-sized rocks from the natural amphitheater at the top of the hill. The back side of the pile of boulders was more precipitous than the front, and the rim of the hilltop on that side formed a naturally defensible wall. The young knights piled up enough rock to form a crude kind of breastwork around the other three sides. It was all very casual, but within an hour some fairly substantial fortifications had been erected. There were many cooking fires around the base of the hill, and their smoke laid a kind of blue haze out among the white tree trunks. There was a great deal of clanking and rattling and shouting back and forth as the oddly assorted force made some show of preparing a meal. Engessa's Etons gathered up large piles of firewood, mostly in 10-foot lengths, and all of the cooks stated a loud preference for wood chips for their fires rather than chunks. It was therefore necessary to chop at the ends of the birch logs, and there were soon neat piles of sharpened 10-foot poles spaced out at regular intervals around the hill, ready for use either as firewood or as a palisade that could be erected in a few minutes. The knights and the Paloi tethered their horses nearby and lounged around the foot of the hill, while the Etons were evenly dispersed a bit farther out under the trees. Sparhawk stood at the top of the hill surveying the progress of the work below. The ladies were gathered under a broad canopy erected on poles in the center of the depressed basin on the hilltop. Stragan was strumming his lute and singing to them in his deep, rich voice.
"How's it going down there?" Talon asked, coming up to where Sparhawk stood.
"It's about as secure as Khalad can make it without being obvious about it," Sparhawk replied.
"He's awfully good, isn't he?" Talon said with a certain pride.
"Your brother? Oh, yes. Your father trained him very well."
"It might have been nice to grow up with my brothers." Talon sounded a bit wistful. He shrugged. "But then..." He peered out at the forest. "Any word from Engessa?"
"Our friends are still out there."
"They're going to attack, aren't they?"
"Probably. You don't gather that many armed men in one place without having something military in mind."
"I like your plan here, Sparhawk, but I think it's got a hole in it."
"Oh?"
"Once they finally realize that we aren't going to move from this spot, they might decide to wait and then come at us after dark. Fighting at night's a lot different from doing it in the daytime, isn't it?"
"Usually, yes. But we'll cheat." Talon gave him a quizzical look.
There are a couple of spells that brighten things up when you need to see.
I keep forgetting about that.
You might as well get used to it, Talon, Sparhawk told him with a faint smile. When we get back home, you're going to start your novitiate.
When did we decide that?
Just now. You're old enough, and if you keep on growing the way you have been lately, you'll be big enough.
Is magic hard to learn?
You have to pay attention. It's all done in Styrek, and Styrek's a tricky language. If you use the wrong word, all sorts of things can go wrong.
Thanks, Sparhawk. That's all I need. Something else to worry about.
We'll talk with Sephrenia when we get to Sarsos. Maybe she'll agree to train you. Flute likes you, so she'll forgive you if you make any mistakes.
What's Flute got to do with it?
If Sephrenia trains you, you'll be submitting your requests to Afriel.
Requests?
That's what magic is, Talon. You ask a god to do something for you.
Praying?
The boy asked incredulously.
Sort of. Does Amban know that you're praying to a Styrek goddess?
More than likely. The church chooses to ignore the fact, though, for practical reasons.
She's a hypocrite, then.
I wouldn't mention that to Amban if I were you.
Let me get this straight. If I get to be a church knight, I'll be worshipping Flute?
Praying to her, Talon. I didn't say anything about worshipping.
Praying? Worshipping? What's the difference?
Sephrenia will explain it.
She's in Sarsos, you say?
I didn't say that. Sparhawk silently cursed his careless tongue.
Yes, as a matter of fact, you did.
All right, but keep it to yourself.
That's why we came overland, isn't it?
One of the reasons, yes. Haven't you got something else to do?
Not really, no.
Go find something, because if you don't, I will.
You don't have to get all huffy.
Sparhawk gave him a steady stare.
All right, don't get excited. I'll go entertain Danae and her cat.
Sparhawk stood watching the boy as he returned to the festivities under the canopy. It was obviously time to start being a little careful around Talon. He was dangerously intelligent, and a slip of the tongue might give away things that were supposed to be kept private. The discussion had raised an issue, however. Sparhawk went back to the group gathered on the hilltop and took Barret aside. Go tell the knights that if those people out there decide to wait until after dark to attack, I'll take care of giving us light to work by. If we all try to do it at the same time, we might confuse things. Barret nodded. Sparhawk considered it further. And I'll go talk with Kring and Engessa, he added. We don't want the Aetons and the Paloi going into a panic if the sky suddenly lights up along about midnight tonight.
Is that what you're going to do?
Barret asked. It usually works out about the best in cases like this. One big light's easier to control than several hundred little ones, and it disrupts the enemy's concentration a lot more. Barret grinned.
It would be a little startling to be creeping through the bushes and have the sun come back up again, wouldn't it?
A lot of battles have been averted by lighting up the night, Barret, and a battle averted is sometimes even better than one you win.
I'll remember that, Sparhawk.
The afternoon wore on, and the party on the hilltop became a little strained. There were only so many things to laugh at, and only so many jokes to tell. The warriors around the base of the hill either spent their time attending to equipment or pretending to sleep. Sparhawk met with the others about mid-afternoon out near the road. If they don't know by now that we aren't going any further today, they aren't very bright, Carlton noted. We do look a bit settled in, don't we? Ulof agreed. A suggestion, Sparhawk? Tinian offered. Why do you always say that?
Habit, I suppose. I was taught to be polite to my elders. Even the best of spells isn't going to give us the same kind of light we'll have before the sun goes down. We know they're out there, we're in position, and we're rested. Why don't we push things a bit? If we can force them to attack now, we can fight them in daylight.
How are you going to make somebody attack when he doesn't want to? Patriarch Amban asked.
We start making obvious preparations, Your Grace, Tinian replied. It's logical to start on the field fortifications about now anyway. Let's put up the palisade around the foot of the hill and start digging ditches.
And cutting trees, Ulof added. We could clear away some avenues leading out into the woods and pile all the tree trunks up where they'll hinder anybody trying to come through the forest. If they're going to attack,
Let's make them attack across open ground.
It took a surprisingly short time. The logs for the fence around the base of the hill were already sharpened and stacked in neat piles where they were handy. Digging them in was an easy matter. The birch trees in the forest were all no more than 10 inches thick at the base, and they fell quickly to the axes of the warriors and were dragged into the surrounding forest to form large, jumbled piles that would be virtually impossible to penetrate, even for men on foot. Sparhawk and the others went back up to the hilltop to survey their preparations.
"Why don't they attack us now, before we're ready?"
Imban tensely asked the knights.
"Because it takes time to organize an attack, Your Grace," Bivier explained. "The scouts have to run back and tell the generals what we're doing. The generals have to sneak through the woods to have a look for themselves, and then they all have to get together and argue about what they're going to do. They were planning an ambush. They aren't really ready to attack fortified positions. The business of adjusting one's thinking to a different tactical situation is what takes the longest."
"How long?"
"It depends entirely on the personality of the man in charge. If his mind was really set on an ambush, it could take him as long as a week."
"He's dead, then, Bevier Knight," Engessa told the Cyrenic tersely. "As soon as we saw the warriors in the woods, I dispatched a dozen of my people to the garrison at Sarsos. If our enemy takes more than 2 days to make up his mind, he'll have 5,000 Etons climbing his back."
"Sound thinking, Etan Engessa," Tinian approved.
He pondered it.
"A thought, Sparhawk.
If our friend out there gets all caught up in indecision, we can just continue to strengthen our defenses around this hill. Ditches, sharpened stakes, the usual encumbrances. Each improvement we add will make him think things over that much longer, which will give us time to add more fortifications, which will make him think all the more. If we can keep him thinking for 2 days, the Etons from Sarsos will come up behind him and wipe out his force before he ever gets around to using it."
"Good point," Sparhawk agreed. "Let's get to it."
"I thought that being a military person just involved banging on people with axes and swords,"
Imban conceded.
"There's a lot of that involved, Your Grace," Uloth smiled. "But it doesn't hurt to outsmart your enemy a little, too."
He looked at Bevier.
"Engines?" he asked.
Bevier blinked.
Uloth's cryptic questions always took him by surprise for some reason. "As long as we have some time on our hands, we could erect some catapults on the hilltop. Attacking through a rain of boulders is always sort of distracting. Getting hit on the head with a 50-pound rock seems to break a man's concentration for some reason. If we're going to set up for a siege, we might as well do it right."
He looked around at them.
"I still don't like sieges, though," he added. "I want everybody to understand that."
The warriors set to work, and the ladies and the young men attending them renewed their festivities, although their hilarity was even more forced now. Sparhawk and Calton were reinforcing the breastworks atop the hill. Since his wife and daughter were going to be inside those fortifications, their strength was a matter of more than passing interest to the prince consort. The party under the pavilion had begun to show gaps, and Stragan was increasingly obliged to fill them with his loot.
"He's going to wear out his fingers,"
Calton grunted, lifting another large rock into place.
"Stragan enjoys attention," Sparhawk shrugged. "He'll keep playing until the blood runs out from under his fingernails, if there's anybody around to listen."
Stragan's lute took up a very old air, and he began to sing again. Sparhawk didn't really have much of an ear for music, but he had to admit that the Felesian thief had a beautiful voice. And then Baroness Melodir joined in. Her voice was a rich contralto that blended smoothly with Stragan's baritone. Their duet was perfectly balanced, smooth and rich with the dark tones of their deeper voices. Sparhawk smiled to himself. The Baroness was continuing her campaign. Once Afriel had alerted him to the blonde girl's designs on Stragan, Sparhawk could see dozens of artful little ploys she was using to keep her intended victim's attention. He almost felt sorry for Stragan, but he conceded that Melodir would be good for him. The pair concluded their duet to loud applause. Sparhawk glanced toward the pavilion and saw Melodir lay one lingering hand almost caressingly on Stragan's wrist. Sparhawk knew just how potent those accidental-seeming contacts were.
Lilius had explained it to him once, and Lilius had been the world's champion seductress, as probably half the men in Jirok could have sworn to. Then Stragan turned to another traditional air, and a new voice lifted in song. Colton dropped the rock he had been lifting. It fell onto his foot, but he did not even wince. The voice was that of an angel, high, sweet, and as clear as glass. It soared effortlessly toward the upper reaches of the soprano range. It was a lyric voice, uncontaminated by the subtle variations of the coloratura, and it seemed as untaught as birdsong. It was Elana's maid, Aileen. The doe-eyed girl, always so quiet and unassuming, stood in the center of the pavilion, her face luminous as she sang. Sparhawk heard Colton snuffle, and he was astonished to see great tears streaming down his friend's face as the blonde Pandion wept unashamed. Perhaps his recent conversation with the child goddess had alerted Sparhawk to the potentials of intuition. He suddenly knew, without knowing exactly how he knew, that two campaigns were in progress, and, moreover, that the one being waged by Baroness Melodir was the more overt and blatant. He carefully concealed a smile behind his hand.
"Lord, that girl's got a beautiful voice," Colton said in stunned admiration as Aileen concluded her song. "God," he said then, doubling over to clutch at the foot he had unwittingly injured 5 minutes earlier.
The work progressed until sunset, and then the combined army pulled back behind the reinforced palisade and waited. Sir Bevier and his Cyrenic knights retired to the hilltop, where they completed the construction of their catapults. Then they amused themselves by lobbing large rocks into the forest, seemingly at random.
"What are they shooting at, Sparhawk?"
Elana asked after supper.
"The trees."
He shrugged.
"The trees aren't threatening us."
"No, but there are probably people hiding among them. The boulders falling out of the sky should make them a little jumpy."
He smiled.
"Actually, Bevier's men are testing the range of the engines, dear. If our friends in the forest decide to attack down those avenues we've provided for them, Bevier wants to know exactly when to start shooting."
"There's a great deal more involved in being a soldier than just keeping your equipment clean, isn't there?"
"I'm glad you appreciate that, my queen."
"Shall we go to bed, then?"
"Sorry, Elana," he replied, "but I won't be sleeping tonight. If our friend out there makes up his mind and attacks, there are some things I'll have to do rather quickly."
He looked around.
"Where's Danae?"
"She and Talon are over there watching Bevier's people throw rocks at the trees."
"I'll go get her. You'll probably want to keep her close to you tonight."
He crossed the basin to where Bevier was directing the activities of his knights.
"Bedtime,"
he told his daughter, lifting her into his arms. She pouted a little at that, but raised no other objections. When Sparhawk was about halfway back to his wife's tent, he slowed.
"How much of a stickler are you for formality, Afriel?" he asked.
"A few genuflections are nice, father," she replied, "but I can live without them, in an emergency."
"Good. If the attack comes tonight, we're going to need some light to see them by."
"How much light?"
"Sort of noonish would be good."
"I can't do that, Sparhawk. Do you have any idea of how much trouble I'd get into if I made the sun rise when it wasn't supposed to?"
"I wasn't really suggesting that. I just want enough light so that people can't sneak up on us through the shadows. The spell's a fairly long one, with a lot of formalities involved and many, many specifics. I may be a little pressed for time. So would you be terribly offended if I just asked you for light and left the details up to you?"
"It's highly irregular, Sparhawk,"
she chided him primly.
"I know, but just this once, maybe?"
"Oh, I guess so. But let's not make a habit of it. I do have a reputation to maintain, after all."
"I love you," he laughed.
"Oh, if that's the case, it's perfectly all right, then. We can bend all sorts of rules for people who really love us. Just ask for light, Sparhawk. I'll see to it that you get lots and lots of light."
The attack came shortly before midnight. It began with a rain of arrows lofting out of the darkness, followed quickly by attacks on the Aton pickets. That last proved to be what might best be described as a tactical blunder. The Atons were the finest foot soldiers in the world, and they welcomed hand-to-hand combat.
Sparhawk could not clearly see the attacking force from his vantage point on the hilltop, but he firmly controlled his curiosity and held off on illuminating the battlefield until such time as the opposing force was more fully engaged. As they had anticipated, their enemies used the cover of these first probing moves to attack the log jams designed to impede their progress through the belts of trees set off by Sir Ulof's avenues radiating out from the base of the hill like the spokes of a huge wheel. As it turned out, Bevier's Cyrenix had not been lobbing rocks out into the forest entirely for the fun of it. They had rather precisely pinpointed the range of those jumbles of fallen trees with their catapults, and they hurled baskets full of fist-sized rocks into the air to rain down on the men attempting to tear down the barricades or to widen the narrow gaps that had been deliberately left to permit the Peloi to ride out in search of entertainment. A 2-pound rock falling out of the sky will not crush a man, but it will break his bones, and after 10 minutes or so, the men out in the woods withdrew.
"I confess to you, Sparhawk Knight," N'Gessa said gravely. "I had thought your elaborate preparations a bit silly. Etons do not fight so. Your approach does have certain advantages, though."
"Our societies are different, Etan and N'Gessa. Your people live and fight in wilderness, where enemies are encountered singly or in small groups. Our wilderness has been tamed, so our enemies come at us in large numbers. We build forts to live in, and over the centuries we've devised many means to defend those forts."
"When will you make the light come?"
"At a time when it's most inconvenient for our enemy. I want him to commit a large part of his force, and to have them fully engaged before I sweep away the darkness. He won't expect that, and it takes time to get orders through to men who are already fighting. We should be able to eliminate a sizable part of his army before he can pull them back. Defensive warfare has certain advantages, if you make the proper preparations."
"Ulof Knight does not like it."
"Ulof doesn't have the patience for it. Bevier's the expert on defense. He'd be perfectly willing to wait for 10 years, if need be, for the enemy to come to him on his terms."
"What will the enemy do next? We Etons are not accustomed to interrupted fights."
"He'll draw back and shoot arrows at us while he thinks things over. Then he'll probably try a direct assault down one of those avenues."
"Why only one? Why not attack from all directions at once?"
"Because he doesn't know how much we can hurt him yet. He'll have to find that out first." "He'll learn in time, but it's going to cost him a great deal to get his education. After we've killed about half of his soldiers, he'll do one of two things. He'll either go away, or he'll throw everything he's got at us from all sides at once."
"And then?"
"Then we'll kill the rest of his soldiers and be on our way." Sparhawk shrugged. "Assuming that everything goes the way we've planned, of course." At 200 paces, and with only starlight to see by, the figures were hardly more than shadows. They marched out into the center of one of Ulof's corridors, and halted, while others filed out to join them and to form up into a kind of massed formation.
"I can't believe that,"
Carlton exclaimed, gaping at the shadowy soldiers at the end of the corridor.
"Is something wrong, Sir Carlton?"
M. Ben's voice was a little shrill.
"Not in the least, Your Grace," Carlton replied gaily. "It's just that we're dealing with an idiot."
He turned his head slightly.
"Bevier," he called. "He's forming up his troops on the road to march them into place."
"You're not serious."
"May all of my toenails fall out if I'm not."
Bevier barked a number of commands, and his knights swung the catapults around to bring them to bear on the unseen avenue leading toward the road.
"Give the word, Sparhawk,"
the young Cyrenic called.
"We're going on down now," Sparhawk called back. "You can start as soon as we reach the bottom. We'll wait so that you can pound them for a while, and then we'll charge. We'd take it as a kindness if you'd stop about then."
Bevier grinned at him.
"Look after my wife while I'm gone."
"Naturally."
Sparhawk and the other warriors began to climb down the hill.
"I'll break my men into 2 groups, friend Sparhawk," Kring said. "We'll circle around and come up onto the road about a 30 miles behind them on either side. We'll wait for your signal there."
"Don't kill all of them," N'Gessa cautioned. My Aetons grow sulky if there's fighting and they aren't allowed to participate. They reached the bottom of the hill, and Bevier's catapults began to thud, launching large rocks this time. There were sounds from off in the direction of the road, indicating that the Cyrenic knights had found the proper range.
Luck, Sparhawk, Kring said tersely, and melted off into the shadows.
Be careful, Sir Knights, Khalad cautioned them. Those tree stumps out there are dangerous in the dark.
It won't be dark when we charge, Khalad, Sparhawk assured him. I've made some arrangements.
And Gessa slipped quietly through an opening in the palisade to join his warriors out in the forest.
Is it just my imagination, or does it seem to the rest of you that we're dealing with someone who's not really very sophisticated? Tinian said. He doesn't seem to have any conception of modern warfare or modern technology.
I think the word you're groping for is stupid, Tinian, Colton chuckled.
I'm not so sure, Tinian frowned. It was too dark for me to make out very much from the hilltop, but it looked almost as if he were forming up his troops into a phalanx. Nobody's done that in the West for over 1,000 years.
It wouldn't be very effective against mounted knights, would it? Colton asked.
I'm not so sure. It would depend on how long his spears are and the size of those overlapping shields. He could give us trouble.
Barrett, Sparhawk said, go back up the hill and tell Bevier to shift his catapults a bit. I'd like the enemy formation broken up.
Right. The young knight turned and scrambled back up the hill. If he is using a phalanx formation, Tinian continued, it means that he's never come up against mounted troops before, and that he's used to fighting in open country. Bevier's catapults began to hurl boulders at the shadowy formation at the far end of the cleared avenue.
Let's get started, Sparhawk decided. I was going to wait a while, but let's see what we're up against.
He hauled himself up onto Farron's back and led the knights to a position outside the palisade. Then he drew in a deep breath.
We could use a bit of light now, Divine One.
He cast the thought out without even bothering to frame it in Styric.
That's really improper, Sparhawk.
Afriel's voice in his ear was tart.
You know I'm not supposed to respond to prayers in Alenic.
You know both languages. What difference does it make?
It's a question of style, Sparhawk.
I'll try to do better next time.
I'd really appreciate it. How's this?
It began as a kind of pulsating lavender glow along the northern horizon. Then long streaks of pure, multicolored light spread upward in seething, curtain-like sheets, wavering, undulating like a vast veil shimmering against the night sky.
What is it?
Khalad exclaimed.
The northern lights, Uloth grunted. I've never seen them this far south, or quite so bright. I'm impressed, Sparhawk.
The shimmering curtain of light, rising and falling, crept up and up into the darkness, erasing the stars and filling the night with rainbow light. A huge groan of consternation and awe rose from the army massing near the road. Sparhawk looked intently down the stump-dotted avenue. The soldiers facing them wore antique armor, breastplates, horsehair-crested helmets, and large round shields. They wore short swords and carried 12-foot spears. Their front rank had evidently been formed with overlapping shields and advanced spears. Bevier's catapults, however, had broken those tightly packed ranks, and the rain of boulders continued to smash down among men so jammed together they could not flee. Sparhawk watched grimly for a few moments.
All right, Uloth, he said at last. Sing the ogre's song for them.
Uloth grinned and lifted his curled ogre horn to his lips and blew a single, deep-toned blast. The massed foot troops, their ranks broken by the catapults and their minds filled with wonder and dismay by the sudden brilliant light covering half the sky, were in no way prepared to meet the awesome charge of the armored knights and their massive horses. There was a resounding crash, and the front ranks of the massed foot soldiers fell beneath the churning hooves of the war horses. The knights discarded their lances, drew their swords and axes, and fell to work, carving great swathes through the tightly packed ranks.
Uloth!
Sparhawk bellowed.
Turn loose the poloi!
Sir Uloth blew his ogre horn again, twice this time. The poloi war cries were shrill and ululating.
Sparhawk glanced quickly along the road. The warriors Kring's Paloi were attacking were not the same as the ones facing the knights. Sparhawk had led a charge against infantry, men in breastplates and horsehair-crested helmets who fought on foot. Kring was attacking mounted men, men wearing flowing robes and cloth head coverings, all armed with curved swords, much like the Paloi sabers. Quite obviously, the attacking force was comprised of two different elements. There would be time later to ponder those differences. Right now, they were all very busy. Sparhawk swung his heavy broadsword rhythmically in huge overhead strokes that sheared down into the sea of horsehair-crested helmets surrounding him. He continued for several minutes, until the sounds from along the road indicated that the Paloi were fully engaged.
"Sir Uloth," he roared, "ask the Aetons to join us."
The ogre horn sang again, and yet once again. Sounds of fighting erupted back among the trees. Enemy soldiers who had fled the charge of the knights and the slashing attack of the Paloi found no sanctuary in the woods, and Gessa's Aetons, silent and deadly, moved through the eerie multicolored light streaming down from the pulsating sky, seeking and destroying.
"Sparhawk!" Kalton shouted. "Look!"
Sparhawk jerked his head around, and his heart froze.
"I thought that thing was dead!"
Kalton exclaimed. The figure was robed and hooded all in black, and it was astride a gaunt horse. A kind of greenish nimbus surrounded it, and waves of implacable hatred seemed to shimmer out from it. Sparhawk looked a bit more closely, and then let out his breath, relieved.
"It's not a seeker," he told Kalton. "It's got human hands. It's probably the one we've been fighting, though."
Then another man in black rode out from farther back in the trees. This one wore exaggeratedly dramatic clothing. He had on a black, wide-brimmed hat, and wore a black bag with ragged eye-holes over his head.
"Has this all been some sort of joke?" Tinian demanded. "Is that who I think it is?"
"I'd guess that it's the one in the robe who's been in charge," Uloth said. "I doubt that Saber could successfully herd goats."
"Savor thine empty victory, Anaka,"
the hooded figure called in a hollow, strangely metallic voice.
"I did but test thee, that I might discern thy strength and thy weaknesses. Go thy ways now. I have learned what I needed to learn. I will trouble thee no further, for now. But mistake me not, O man without destiny. We will meet anon, and in our next meeting shall I try thee more significantly."
Then Saber and his hooded companion wavered and vanished. The wailing and groaning of the wounded enemies all around them suddenly broke off. Sparhawk looked around quickly. The strangely armored foot troops he and his friends had been fighting were all gone. Only the dead remained. Back along the road in either direction, Kring's Paloi were reining in their horses in amazement. The troops they had engaged had vanished as well, and startled exclamations from back among the trees indicated that the Aetons had also been bereft of enemies.
"What's going on here?" Kalton exclaimed. "I'm not sure," Sparhawk replied, "but I am sure that I don't like it very much."
He swung down from his saddle and turned one of the fallen enemies over with his foot. The body was little more than a dried husk, browned, withered, and totally desiccated. It looked very much like the body of a man who had been dead for several centuries at least.
"We've encountered it once before, Your Grace," Tinian was explaining to Patriarch Emban.
It was nearly morning, and they were gathered once again atop the rocky hill.
"Last time it was antique Lamorks. I don't know what kind of antiques these were."
He looked at the two mummified corpses the Aetons had brought up the hill.
"This one is a Senescan," Ambassador Oscania said, pointing at one of the dead men.
"Looks almost like a Rendor, doesn't he?" Talon observed.
"There would be certain similarities," Oscania agreed. "Senesca is a desert, much like Rendor, and there are only so many kinds of clothing suitable for such a climate."
The dead man in question was garbed in a flowing, loose-fitting robe, and his head was covered with a sort of cloth winding that flowed down to protect the back of his neck.
"They aren't very good fighters," Kring told them. "They all sort of went to pieces when we charged them."
What about the other one, Your Excellency? Tinian asked. These ones in armor were very good fighters. The Tamil ambassador's eyes grew troubled. That one's a figment of someone's imagination, he declared. I don't really think so, Your Excellency, Sir Bevier disagreed. The men we encountered back in Eosia had been drawn from the past. They were fairly exotic, I'll grant you, but they had been living men once. Everything we've seen here tells us that we've run into the same thing again. This fellow's most definitely not an imaginary soldier. He did live once, and what he's wearing was his customary garb. It's impossible, Oscania declared adamantly. Just for the sake of speculation, Oscania, Amban said, let's shelve the word impossible for the time being. Who would you say he was if he weren't impossible?
It's a very old legend, Oscania said, his face still troubled. We're told that once, a long, long time ago, there were people in Seneska who predated the current inhabitants. The legend calls them Sirgai. Modern Seneskans are supposed to be their degenerate descendants.
They look as if they come from two different parts of the world, Carlton noted.
Sirga, the city of the Sirgai, was supposed to lie in the central highlands of Seneska, Oscania told him. It's higher than the surrounding desert, and the legend says there was a large spring-fed lake there. The stories say that the climate there was markedly different from that of the desert. The Sirgai wouldn't have needed protection from the sun the way their bastard offspring would have. I'd imagine that there were indications of rank and status involved as well. Given the nature of the Sirgai, they'd have definitely wanted to keep their inferiors from wearing the Sirgai costume.
They lived at the same time, then? Tinian asked.
The legends are a little vague on that score, Sir Tinian. Evidently there was a period when the Sirgai and the Seneskans coexisted. The Sirgai would certainly have been dominant, though. He made a face. Why am I talking this way about a myth? He said plaintively. This is a fairly substantial myth, Oscania, Amban said, nudging the mummified Sirgai with his foot. I gather that these fellows had something of a reputation?
Oh, yes, Oscania said with distaste. They had a hideous culture, all cruelty and militarism. They held themselves aloof from other peoples in order to avoid what they called contamination. They were said to be obsessively concerned with racial purity, and they were militantly opposed to any new ideas. That's a futile sort of obsession, Tinian noted. Any time you engage in trade, you're going to encounter new ideas.
The legends tell us they understood that, Sir Knight. Trade was forbidden.
No commerce at all? Carlton asked incredulously.
Oscania shook his head. They were supposed to be totally self-sufficient. They even went so far as to forbid the possession of gold or silver in their society.
Monstrous! Stragan exclaimed. They had no money at all?
Iron bars, we're told. Heavy ones, I guess. It tended to discourage trade. They lived only for war. All the men were in the army, and all the women spent their time having babies. When they grew too old to either fight or bear children, they were expected to kill themselves. The legends say that they were the finest soldiers the world has ever known.
The legends are exaggerated, Oscania, Engesa told him. I killed 5 of them myself. They spent a great deal of time flexing their muscles and posing with their weapons when they should have been paying attention to business.
The ancients were very formal, Eitan Engesa, Oscania murmured.
Who was the fellow in the robe? Carlton asked.
The one who seemed to be trying to pass himself off as a seeker.
I'd guess that he holds a position somewhat akin to Garrick in Lamorcan, and to Saber in Western Astel, Sparhawk surmised. I was a little surprised to see Saber here, he added.
He had to step rather carefully here. Both he and Emban were sworn to secrecy on the matter of Saber's real identity.
Professional courtesy, no doubt, Stragan murmured. The fact that he was here sort of confirms our guess that all these assorted upheavals and disturbances are tied together.
End of Side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.